shortly with David Heap, Canada Boat to Gaza. There's, by the way, Phil Connor is here. Yeah, there's a lot of groups involved. It's a great worldwide effort, this thing of trying to take supplies and of a non-military type.
There are a lot of what you would call prominent citizens from other countries. And, you know, the Israelis, when they decide to intercept it at sea, I mean, they're involving a lot of other countries, whether they want to or not. I mean, it's inevitable.
Yes. Yeah. I guess the best we can say, well, the first thing we can say is it's a bad press for a Navy that intercepts people 115 miles, is
it? We say 115 miles.
115 yeah. miles in the Mediterranean. And we are joined now, I believe, by David Heap, CanadaBoatGaza.org. Are you there, David?
Yes, I am. Good to speak to you again, Phil.
Well, it's certainly good to talk to you. And look, let's get right to the latest news. What are you hearing, and what should Canadians need to know here?
Well, Canadians need to know that, once again, and to no one's surprise, our government doesn't represent us and doesn't represent our opinions, and they remain completely complicit with Israel's international crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, less than 24 hours ago, a boat under a Swedish flag, a friendly nation to us, was boarded by Israeli military personnel, and, you know, they taken to a country where they weren't destined, right? They were sailing in international waters towards Palestinian territorial waters off Gaza, and they were forced, you know, by military force. Mm-hmm. The boat was taken to Ashdod in Israel, which was never their destination. Obviously, none of our boats ever have Israel as a destination. They were forced to enter a country which wasn't their destination against their will. So this, you know, international traffic of people against their will. And, of course, a boat is stolen and all the equipment on it is stolen, including international journalists' broadcast equipment. Mm-hmm. Because the one thing the occupiers' military never wants is for there to be any record of it, right? So they block all the satellite signals, they block all the radio, the sat phone signals, and all kinds of broadcasting. So they're the only ones who own the image and the story for the first 12 to 24 hours at least.
Yeah. Well,
so that's how they can claim in their press release, oh, it was an uneventful boarding. We just visited them and expected them and forced, you know, took their boat somewhere else. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but if I was visited on my boat by military command boats, I would find that kind of eventful.
Yeah, that's eventful. Yes.
Yeah, and since the boat just
it is international water. By the way, it's 115 miles.
It's 100
in the Mediterranean.
In the Mediterranean, it's 100 just over 100 nautical miles.
Isn't that piracy?
Well, that's a good question. And given that the flag state in this case is Sweden, we'll be very interested to see how Sweden reacts, either diplomatically or with legal proceedings at the International Court of the Sea. That's not in our hands, but it certainly put the focus on how Sweden is going to proceed and how the rest of Europe, quite frankly, will view an attack on a boat with a European flag.
Mm-hmm.
But just to go back to this 100 nautical mile thing, I mean, Israel has this legal fiction of their exclusion zone in that area, but that has no status in international law. I mean, nobody can claim 100 nautical miles just like that. And in fact, if they're close to any state where they were boarded, was closer to Egyptian territorial waters than anything else. And then the last signals we had were just outside of 100 nautical miles, so it was probably in the range of 90 to 100 nautical miles. But in addition to the fact that, you know, military commandos coming on your boat and taking over is eventful in itself, they always try to make it sound like it's peaceful. What we just heard, because the boat just got to Ashdod and our friends are being interrogated there, is that at least one of the Swedish sailors was attacked with a taser.
Mm-hmm.
Which is completely unnecessary. So they always say there's no violence, and then it comes out afterwards, as in my case, well, yeah, actually, I was tasered. And in 2012, a number of the Europeans were tasered, in some cases repeatedly, which is, you know, clearly not only violent but uncalled for. I mean, these are people who are not resisting, and they're being tasered.
Well,
I don't know. Tasers
are a very dangerous instrument. It certainly has caused deaths in a number of instances.
And when they know that these people who are committed to nonviolence and have been trained in nonviolence, there's absolutely no justification for using something like a taser. And then to call it uneventful is simply, you know, adding insult to injury.
It's certainly
so
an event.
Yeah, sorry?
I was just saying, I mean, it's you're right. I mean, the corruption of language, because it's an event when a military ship intercepts a civilian ship.
Yep.
And boards it, already you have an event.
Exactly. In international waters, flying, legally flying the flag of another nation, that by definition is an incident. And then to take a bunch of people into detention or kidnap them on the high seas and steal their equipment and goods and subject them to tasering and illegal confinement.
Yeah.
All of these are forcing them to enter a country which against their will. All of these are illegal acts in international law. Mm-hmm. The problem is, Phil, as you and I know, and that's why you say what the Canadians need to know, this happens because we allow it to happen. Maybe not you and me and your listeners, but the governments of our countries allow this to happen. Israel gets away with what it gets away with, all of these crimes, because Harper, Obama, successive Canadian governments, it wasn't much different under previous Canadian governments, a little different, previous U.S. governments. So the U.S. and Canada sort of vie for being the most pro-Zionist. But even the European Union gives Israel carte blanche. They let them get away with this, right? So that's what we have to change, right? We're sailing in small boats toward a country in the Eastern Mediterranean, but we're really sailing against the occupation there and against our own government, right? And we sail with not just, a dozen or a dozen and a half internationals on that boat. We sail with lots and thousands of people on board with this campaign, more and more every time, who know that, they may not be able to get on board a boat with us. That's a big commitment. But they are getting on board now with writing and calling the Canadian Foreign Minister and saying this is unacceptable. It's unacceptable to do this to Canadians and other internationals who are trying to sail to Gaza. But it's even more unacceptable to subject Palestinians in Gaza to this kind of restriction day in, day out, year in, year out we're over 8 years now of this blockade.
Yeah, and let me ask you about that. The Israeli Prime Minister always makes it a point to start talking about Hamas and about arms. Isn't this somewhat absurd? I mean, all they had to do was check and say, go about your business, right?
They could have inspected. In fact,
is there no arms and just say, go about your business?
There were boats that came through in 2008 and were just, sort of asked questions and then allowed to go on. So there's many possibilities. They could be inspected at their point of origin. We've always invited the UN or European authorities to say, inspect these boats. In fact, they are often port authorities and maritime police inspect these boats before they leave Europe. So there's lots of other ways. If Israel's security was the question, there's lots of other ways of addressing that. What this is really about is strangling the Palestinian economy and making it completely dependent on the occupier's economy, right? Because if nothing comes in and nothing goes out, they have no choice but to buy everything they get through the controlled access by their occupier. So this is a really good deal, right? You got 1.8 billion million people, almost a million people. Most of them kids,
a captive market.
It's literally a captive market, right? Occupation pays.
In the most vulgar use of the word.
It's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. The occupation is extremely lucrative because all of those people have to buy in their occupier's currency stuff that they're occupying. I mean, imagine stuff that their occupier is selling them. Imagine the indignity of having your homes and your schools and your mosque and your hospital shelled and then say, you know what? You got to buy the material from the person who did the shelling. Pretty good deal, eh? And not only that, they're going to turn around and sell those arms to Europeans and North Americans and other countries and say, hey, look, we tested them on the Palestinians. They're battle-tested. That's what they market
them. It is a selling, yes, the marketer says these are battle-tested.
Absolutely. So this is very, very lucrative. Yeah. Bombing and killing Palestinians, then selling them by, eyedropper, little amounts of reconstruction, and profiting both on the weapons and on keeping them in occupation or under occupation. So the call here is simply for freedom of movement. It's not that the sea is more important than the land. I mean, we want freedom of movement for Palestinians within Palestine, obviously, as well. Mm-hmm. The call is for freedom of movement, and the sea is part of freedom of movement. Any other coastal nation in the world has access to its own territorial waters and to international waters. You can sail out from any other country in the Mediterranean and travel and trade and fish in the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. Palestinians can't even fish their own waters safely. Fishermen or fishing boats are shot at every week practically by the occupation. Fishers have their boats damaged and confiscated and whatnot. They get detained and injured and sometimes killed. Palestinian farmers in Gaza can't farm their lands in many cases because they're shot at. They have their crops and their trees destroyed. And of course, they can't travel the world for educational purposes, for medical purposes, for trade, or any other reason. I mean, I'm as an educator.
Somebody put an iron curtain around them.
Yeah, it's a concrete nasty wall. But if you think of young people, I mean, you're a university radio station. I'm an educator. Most of these people are minors. They never voted for Hamas because they weren't a voting age, right?
Yeah.
They never voted for anybody. It's an overwhelmingly young population. Very bright, very educated people who want to study and develop their country's economy, and they're prevented from doing that.
Yeah. By the way,
this occupation.
Yeah, this is David Heap, CanadaBoatGaza.org. And I notice in your statement that you point out that there is a concession of one type, perhaps unconscious. They say there is a naval blockade when they also that same prime minister claimed there wasn't a blockade.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is a characteristic of the propaganda, the Hasbara propaganda that comes from an occupier. They talk out of at least two sides of their mouth, maybe more than that. They claim to not occupy Gaza, but at the same time, they do obviously occupy Gaza. They control land, sea, and air access. They control the economy. They control the currency. They control the electricity and the water. They control the civil registry, so you can't get an ID document as a Palestinian in Gaza without going through the civil administration controlled by Israel. So they are completely an occupying power, and occasionally, as you say, at times like this, they let slip, oops, we actually have to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the occupation is there, and we force them to admit it.
Yeah, and that is an important point, by the way, to be that it gets underlined. Can you talk, what about this issue of legality? Some say that there is a sanction for this, there's a lot of legal scholars engaged with it. What's your take on legality of the blockade and the claims that the UN endorses such things?
Well, at the diplomatic level, they managed to get what was called the Palmer Report, right? So you get together an ex-colonial military officer, it was Palmer Uribe Report, right, with a bloody ruler from Colombia. I mean, Uribe was a particularly nasty piece of work who had profited when he was president of Colombia from Israeli repressive technologies and training, right? So he was directly beholden to Israel's repressive machinery, as were many, many of the repressive governments in Latin America and elsewhere. I mean, this is another one of the great Israeli exports, is the machinery of sort of policing and terrorizing and torturing civilian populations. So you get these two people who are very far from partial to make a report, but that's a political report, as often happens at the UN. On the other hand, the UN Human Rights Council has five special rapporteurs on different areas of human rights, on freedom of movement, on women, on right to live with free of poverty. Anyway, different rapporteurs all agreed in 2011 that the blockade is clearly illegal and constitutes, among other things, collective punishment of a civilian population under blockade. And these are the people that it's their job to make legal calls, right? I mean, they're legal experts. They're not politicos like Palmer and Uribe, who made a report that satisfied the great powers that put them there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when people want to talk about the UN, they really ought to be talking about the UN Special Rapporteurs on Human Rights, who were unanimous. 5 out of 5 said, this blockade is illegal because it victimizes a civilian population for acts which, you know, some Palestinians in Gaza, some people in or around Hamas may have committed, which they might, you know, should probably be tried for at the same time Israelis are tried for crimes against civilians in Gaza. But that can't mean, you know, every Israeli civilian is targeted for the crimes of the Israeli military, just as it can't mean that every Palestinian civilian is made to suffer for what might be the crimes of a few. And that's the principle of the Geneva Convention, which says that when you're an occupying power, you're not allowed to, you know, line up a whole village and make them suffer because somebody in there is part of the resistance.
Yeah, to say Hamas doesn't mean you get to starve somebody.
You don't get to starve them. You don't get to shoot at them when they till their land. You don't get to, you know, destroy their fishing nets or their boats when they try to feed their family and their community.
Yeah, actually, you have to assume responsibility for them. Their security is in your hands. If you claim to have a siege or a blockade or an occupation,
their
safety is your job.
Their safety and their well-being and some level of normalcy of civilian life, including freedom of movement. So these are, in fact, very important responsibilities, and thank you for pointing that out, very important responsibilities under the Geneva Convention on an occupying power, which is why Israel tries to skirt the issue of being an occupying power and saying, oh, well, we withdrew. I mean, they withdrew, they redeployed their troops to the perimeter of Gaza, but they retain the prerogative of attacking at any time, of shelling and shooting and military incursions with armored vehicles and bombing and shelling from the sea, right? So this isn't really withdrawing, it's simply redeploying the military to the perimeter of a territory that they still fully control and where they can kill at will.
Yeah.
And as you say, an occupying power has very specific responsibilities in international law, which are, not respected by Israel on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a mark of a civilized country that understands international law. We're speaking to David Heap, and I really thank you for all the time about this. I want to make sure we talk about these two individuals, Bob Stay Human Lovelace and Kevin Nash. What do you know about their status? And tell us a little bit about
them. I'm looking at a photo of somebody that tweeted a picture of the Marianne at dock in Ashdod and sent it to us. So we know the boats arrived, and we know that they're all being interrogated, as they say, which you mean subjected to ritual humiliation by military and security thugs. Kevin has been through this before. Kevin was on the Mavi Marmara in 2010 and saw some pretty hairy things. Bob, of course, is a land defender. He's from former chief of the Ardoch Algonquin First Nation who went to jail here in Ontario for defending his people's land against uranium mining. And eventually his 6 months was cut short to about half when there was a record-making constitutional decision that, in fact, his people must be consulted about uranium mining on their land. So it was land defense that worked. But Bob is used to going to jail. Now, going to the Kingston Pen is, different from being kidnapped on the high seas by the Israeli military. But
he's probably the first Algonquin to have that happen.
Yeah, and he's very clear in his anti-colonial view that he's was sailing to the largest Indian reserve in the world. Those are his words. And it's very clear for him that the treatment of Palestinians throughout Palestine, but particularly Palestinians in Gaza, is reminiscent of the colonial regime under which First Nations live in this country and across Turtle Island. So for him, it's a clear case of indigenous solidarity. And one of the interesting things about the combination of people we got on that boat is they were accompanied by journalists from Māori television in New Zealand. So we haven't yet seen their footage. Some of it got off the boat earlier in the voyage, and we're hoping that Māori TV can broadcast that worldwide, because it really is, it underscores the
fact
that
that would be wonderful.
This is a colonial occupation. It's a settler colonial occupation there, as in many other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob is an example of indigenous resistance, not just on their own lands, but with other indigenous peoples elsewhere in the world. And I think that link is very important to draw between indigenous peoples here in Turtle Island, in Palestine, and everywhere.
Yeah, he gave a great talk at Betzatun. I remember you were there and others, but
yep.
He really laid it out nicely. He reminded us that when Columbus got his contract to go to Cuba, and that he part of the goal had to go toward the next crusade.
Yeah, so it's really bound
that
up.
That was brilliant.
The crusade mentality of Europeans laying waste to what we now call the Middle East in Western Asia, and sacking what they called the New World, really was one of a piece of a racist view of the world. And that talk, an edited version of that talk, can be found on our web channel, our YouTube channel, Canada About Gaza, and on our site, canadaaboutgaza.org or tahrir.ca.
Yeah, and Bob Lovelace himself, if you just Google him, you will find the decolonization blog he does.
Yeah.
David, what do you want? And now, people should call our ministers, right? And the various party people?
Maybe even the so-called
opposition.
Yes. Well, this is an opportunity. I always think of this, people get to choose when they want to be on the right side of history, right? Mm-hmm. So right now we have political elites in Canada and across North America who are solidly lined up with the occupier in Palestine. But we know it can be differently because in Europe there are political parties who take a principled pro-human rights view of the situation in Palestine. In Canada, in North America, we have exactly three shining examples, the three members of Quebec Solidaire in the National Assembly in Quebec, have come out and made a statement. One of them, Manon Massé, sailed with us, tried to sail with us in 2011. They're the only elected people here in Canada that are lining up with this growing consensus that we see in many European countries and other parts of the world. But as you say, our so-called opposition at the federal level is all of a piece pretty much with the support for the occupation. So, yes, please go. We have an appeal on our website. There's an appeal which just got posted this afternoon by Independent Jewish Voices and another one by CJPME, Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. Because, again, as I said before, we're not just sailing in the Eastern Mediterranean against the occupation there. We are sailing with all of you, with all of our listeners, with supporters across Canada and elsewhere in the world against our own government. Because the occupation in Palestine will change when we change hearts and minds here and our politicians figure out that they have to follow civil society and talk about human rights and not just, you know, elite interests in the occupation.
Yeah. Well, David Heap, it's very great to be talking to you. We now know we've got the up-to-date information, and I hope everybody will act on your call. And we look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you very much, Phil. Always great to be on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That's David Heap. And it's CanadaBoatGaza.org. Another one is, I like this hashtag. That means it's Twitter, right? Hashtag, I sail for freedom. Hashtag, freedom flotilla. And in terms of websites, there's ff3.freedomflotilla.org. And there's also Tahrir.ca, T-A-H-R-I-R. We were talking, of course, about Bob Lovelace, and Bob Lovelace has a great website. And as David mentioned, you can find the talk that his most recent statement, actually, from the boat, the Marianne, but he also, from some of the talks he gave before leaving Canada, like at Betsatoon and whatnot, are available. And I really urge our listeners to go there. This is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM.